the devil awakens.
Maximus wrests his life from the underworld.
Hey boy, what in the world are you doing here?
He was elated with his escape.
I wanted out.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.
Well, I was really looking forward to introducing Erica Funkhauser tonight, and when I found out that work commitments prevented me from doing this in person, I was very disappointed. So, thankful to Henry and the Gloucester Writers Center for giving me the opportunity to perhaps be the first video introduction in the fine institution. We like to think about the beatniks as wild and crazy guys, Burroughs and Ginsberg and Kerouac. And they did, I'm sure, lead wild and crazy careers. But in fact, it was their academic cousins who were the really crazy ones. Rutke and Delmore Schwartz, Randall Jarrell, Robert Lowell, of course, and John Berryman, who of all of those poets is perhaps the most deeply damaged in some way, or has the biggest hole in him. There's the lovely poem that he talks about filling himself, need, need, need. And at the same time, Ricky Funkhauser strikes me as being one of the sanest poets I know. So I'm really excited and really curious to see what she's going to do with, how she's going to handle what becomes of John Berryman's gorgeous agony in her hands. And I know you are too, so without further ado, Ricky Funkhauser.
I want to thank Henry and Annie for this amazing institution. You know, not every city has a Gloucester Writers Center, and we're really, really, really fortunate that it's here and that it has so much to offer, so many activities. So I'm honored to be here. John Berryman, now I have to either prove my sanity or insanity, I'm not sure which. The 77 Dream Songs won the Pulitzer Prize in 1965. Robert Lowell had helped Berryman weed the Dream Songs down from hundreds. Several years later, a larger book called The Dream Songs was published, had 385. There are many, many more, both published and unpublished. About that first volume, The 77 Dream Songs, Lowell wrote, "At first the brain aches and freezes at so much darkness, disorder, and oddness." It was an amazing time in the history of poetry. Other books that were published that year in 1965 were Sylvia Plath's Ariel, Elizabeth Bishop's Questions of Travel, George Oppen's This Is Witch, Seamus Heaney's Death of a Naturalist, Zukofsky, Duncan. There's so many more poets. It was also the moment in American poetry when poets were killing themselves more regularly than they are now. Between, say, 1963 and 74, Delmore Schwartz, Randall Jarrell, Theodore Ruskin, Sylvia.
I'm sorry for being a pain here.
Go ahead.
This is another Gloucester thing. Anyway, it was an incredibly difficult time to be a writer, to be a poet. Paradoxically, it was also the time when I think poets were taken the most seriously by the literary community. I was in high school when the Dream Songs first came out, and I was frankly looking for instruction. I wanted to know what a perfect poem was. I wanted to know how to be a poet, how to live that life, how to know whether what I was writing was a poem or not a poem. Behrman was no use whatsoever to me. Absolutely none. I mean, his life was a kind of famous mess. Even I knew that as a high school student. He was an alcoholic, a depressive. Carolyn Kaiser wrote about him that his idea of moderation was a quart of whiskey and four packs of Tarrytons a day. He hospitalized himself multiple times to no avail. His father had committed suicide when Behrman was 12, and Behrman himself committed suicide when he was 58. It was just an enormously difficult life. And yet, Behrman's credo as a writer was really that the best thing for a writer is to undergo any ordeal which won't actually kill you. And he put that into his work. I'm going to read you, before I read my works, which are not dreams and not songs, I wanted to read you a few of Behrman's dream songs in case you don't know his work, just to give you an idea of the multiplicity of voices and attitudes and emotions that course through them. One of the stars of the dream songs is a character named Henry. Behrman swore that he was not Henry, although he and Henry had had a lot of very similar experiences. And the way that he put it in an interview is he said, Henry was in the situation that we all are in actual life. Namely, he didn't know, I don't know, what the bloody fucking hell is going to happen next. This is the Henry of the Dream Songs. The Dream Songs open with this poem. They're very loose sonnets. They're written in three stanzas of six lines each. No regular meter, although most lines are either three-beat lines or five-beat lines, and a very irregular and kind of capricious rhyme scheme. Dream Song 1. Huffy Henry hid the day. Unappeasable Henry sulked. I see his point, a trying to put things over. It was the thought, they thought they could do it, made Henry wicked and away. But he should have come out and talked. All the world, like a woolen lover, once did seem on Henry's side. Then came a departure. Thereafter, nothing fell out as it might or ought. I don't see how Henry, pried open for all the world to see, survived. What he has now to say is a long wonder the world can bear and be. Once in a sycamore, I was glad all at the top, and I sang. Hard on the land, where's the strong sea, and empty grows every bed. Many of the dream songs are complaints against wives, lovers, department heads, lawyers who were after him for money, bankers, many, many complaints. This is one, I think, lodged primarily against his mother. Toward the end of his life, he said, you know, I've been suffering from the death of my father all my life, when actually I should have been suffering from the life of my mother. This is dream song number 14. Life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. After all, the sky flashes. The great sea yearns. We ourselves flash and yearn. And moreover, my mother told me as a boy repeatedly, ever to confess you're bored means you have no inner resources. I conclude now, I have no inner resources because I am heavy bored. Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature. Henry bores me with his plights and gripes as bad as Achilles, who loves people and valiant art, which bores me. And the tranquil hills and gin look like a drag, and somehow a dog has taken itself and its tail considerably away into mountains or sea or sky, leaving behind me, Wag. There's a recurring voice in the dream songs known as Mr. Bones, who's a character straight out of an old-fashioned minstrel show in blackface. And he is a friend who sometimes accompanies Henry, who helps to relieve his solitude, and more often than not corrects him. This is the last dream song I'm going to read to you, but Bones appears in it. I want to give you some flavor of the kind of dialogue that goes on here. It's also a picture of Berryman looking at a woman in a restaurant. I mean, he was a kind of legendary, in his own mind and in everybody else's mind, womanizer. There's a wonderful interview with him done on Brockport, New York TV in 1970, and he says, yeah, I had three wives, and I had infinite number of mistresses, and seven or eight serious relationships, and he's 56 at the time, and he says, and I'm still waiting to figure them out. Women, I can't figure them out. This is dream song number 4. Filling her compact and delicious body with chicken paprika, she glanced at me twice. Fainting with interest, I hungered back, and only the fact of her husband and four other people kept me from springing on her or falling at her little feet and crying, you are the hottest one for years of night. Henry's dazed eyes have enjoyed brilliance. I advanced upon, despairing, my Spumoni. Sir Bones is stuffed to world with feeding girls. Black hair, complexion Latin, jeweled eyes, downcast. The slob beside her feasts. What wonders is she sitting on over there? The restaurant buzzes. She might as well be on Mars. Where did it all go wrong? There ought to be a law against Henry. Mr. Bones, there is. So, how did I find my way back to Berryman? This autumn I went to St. Paul to take care of my grandson for about 4 months. And Berryman had lived in Minneapolis and in St. Paul between about 1955 and 1972. He jumped to his death from the Washington Ave Bridge in Minneapolis, which goes between crosses the Mississippi between the St. Paul and the Minneapolis sides of the U Minnesota campus on a early morning in January in 1972. And I wanted to reread him there, It seemed to me that I was, when I started to reread him, that everything that I had been unable to sort of appreciate as a teenager suddenly seemed to me dead right. I mean, of course life is a mess. Of course emotions are driving us hither and yon. Of course what we read is mixing us up as often as it's clarifying things for us. And So I wanted to try and write some poems into which I could pour as much as possible rather than trying to, you know, the way I usually had customarily worked on poems was to try and get out as much as possible in order to get across my idea of what was important. And that suddenly began to strike me as very false, you know. Who was I to be taking stuff out, you know, before I even knew what the reason was for things to be together in a poem. So I tried to put my experience, what I was reading, and I was reading Behrman, I was also reading two other great drunks, Fitzgerald and Edward St. Albin, and a couple Anglo-Saxon dictionaries, and a book on ethnographic field work, because I was interested that it seemed to me that maybe the way to approach what was going on in this new city, I'd never been in St. Paul before, was as a field worker, as an ethnologist, and I could go around to the kind of events they have in the Midwest, block parties and bonfires, and you know, interview people and get a sense of, you know, what it was like to be from Minnesota. A lot of people in St. Paul are from Minnesota. Okay, you may see that here or not, but the first poem, some of the poems have titles and some don't. The first one is called Dear John. Dear John. Jealousy, envy, greed, pride, self-pity, spite, all endowed with curbside appeal in this borrowed city of civilization, urgent, inoffensive lawn signs, sidewalk sales, everything washed or new, free parks, free zoo, free fern forest, free gymnasium, restrooms unlocked, spotless, a stepping stool for tots. What look like birdhouses along wide sidewalks are book swaps. Take it or leave it, and you'd take some, I wager. Marchette Schutz's biography of Chaucer, or How to Speak to Your Retriever. No contemporary poetry. Dare I tell you, poets no longer swoop or soar or dangle. Our 21st century apertures focused on detachment, not the vast disintegration of one great mind behind a tumbler of amber. In the melting pot, the melting point occurs close to room temperature, its nature cool and digital, a screen event posted anonymously, thumb sucked till numb, not your tube, but our tube, riddled with borrowed reality, a flippancy you might approve of. But no photosynthesis, no footwork, no lightning rod, no exalted descent. The newbies are done with text and context. Look for tax code, taxonomy, redaction. I crave your God, your gallows, your well-attended misogyny, the stubborn excess and self-destructive theatrics, your dreamy antifreeze demolishing Minnesota's signature nice. Even the booze I crave, but especially your songs, so peculiar and distinct, the mind's mess incising the mind's tidiness. Dreams and songs, their vague, unrequited riddles, gnawing and spitting at the spatter paint of articulation. Okay, this poem, you read enough Behrman and he starts to appear to you, and in this poem he appears as a ghost. Porches, Twin Cities. Widely implying idleness, the empty porches lie. Convoys of cloud labor to circumscribe, to crowd broad streets, ample alleys, a chocolate box grid of right angles, block after block of squat, mud-colored hulks make an epic of staying in place. Corner columns 2 feet square, window coffins of stucco. just when it appears that the most a walk will yield is a labeled plot of the world's 50 hottest peppers, starring Naga Viper and Trinidad Scorpion. A wrist of wind drives the indwelt swing down from a gilded sycamore, one quick eccentricity of autumn, joint to joint, a nearly inconceivable anecdote culminating in the ghost poet's bloodhound jowl, river delta whiskers, not giving out bird or bush. Barrowman, on his way home from hospital, tickled to rattle amid shivering wisteria, beaming bad teeth to dumbfounded Easterner. I looked at a lot of the things that Barrowman tells us that he'd looked at from his poems, including a huge piece of jade that's in the Minnesota Institute of Art. It is a carving of an event called the Scholars at the Orchid Pavilion, which actually, this carving in jade was made at the end of the 18th century. The event itself took place in about 343, 353 AD, something like that. All these Chinese scholars got together, 40 or so of them, and they met at the Orchid Pavilion of a famous calligrapher. And they had a kind of a drinking party that went on for days, really. And they would put their cups of wine into the river, at this sort of slow flowing stream, and the poets were seated in all different arrangements on either side of the stream, and wherever the wine cup landed, it was your responsibility, if it was next to you, to drink the wine and compose a poem on the spot. So that that's something that, it's an event that Barrowman writes about. Landscape in ink. Oh, I should also say, in St. Paul, the squirrels are jet black and albino as well as gray. Funny looking things. More like the albino squirrel stumbling on Victoria, its smeared red all-nighter eyes. Or in foliate linden on Linwood, the kettle black screecher at cats. Lacking larger monsters, I look for you in incident. Even worse, in things as flat as the wooden rake lying on the grass, fanned out above ungovernable leaves, a shot man. If only the porch chimes would shut up. Indulging the wind, FedExed from North Dakota, they tinkle and ping and wind up birds imitate, stumbling into each other, stiff, bitter bards, bald or bearded, well off the track as they dawdle beside inky puddles, miles from any green peak. Several discoveries over in the Orchid Pavilion, luminaries of all ages gather to wash and repair the honored graves, brass wine cups tilting afloat in kingfisher blue stream, cinnabar cliffs fountaining with blossoms of plum. Next door, a fresh gust whacks aluminum tubes riveted to pie plate of tin. You are gone. Your little enemies endure. So my grandson, Gabriel, made his way into the work. There's a reference here to a kind of pottery from the Southwest from sort of 1000, 2000 AD called Mimbres pottery, very almost stenciled designs of animals and abstract figures on a plain ground. Art and grandchild. Voids and painted areas interlock. Same is true of Mimbres pots, of riddles, of your kilned songs. Placed over faces of the dead, the ancient clay bowls were punctured at bottom, kill hole for escape of spirit. To that other land, what can be taken? old devil Rilke with Duino question. The hardness of life, a few words. We don't know which words rode with you into the void of January water slapping against the Washington Ave bridge. Not Rilke's bridge, fountain, gate, I bet. Possibly your own crackled jug, fruit tree, window. Do I do anything ever but remember? Were you still eulogizing as you leapt into the river, fatally correcting your father's error? Mud puppy of Minneapolis, you muddled those waters before, supplying yourself with needs, needs and ceremonies. Never entirely clear difference between obstacle, intoxication, boredom, brutality, fear, kindness, inspiration, agony, success. Today, baby I love raptly opens and empties sock drawer. So many times in a row, I am emptied of patience, endurance, anything like right mind. Little boy, newly statuesque on fat feet, hands in command, bends down acutely with each pull, cocking perfect round head sideways to verify rough pine underside of drawer accompanying upper darkness with sky map of folded socks. Baby's head redolent of oatmeal, lettuce, whatever feeding on. When drawer opened most far possible, socks flung to floor like superfluous planets by boy god with pleasure dome eyes. Socks the color of farm animals, softly they land, quiet. Boy's touch delicate even when tossing, not pawing, not laying hold, but with workaday awe, making contact available existence. Every untellable thing then crawled to, collected in warm fist, released back into natural habitat with little gasp like unhooked fish. At once, sock pashes world-making resumes. Closure of drawer, brief impression of forehead against pine, emptying ceremony recommenced. 10 times, 11, but who is counting? I watch, then I'm not watching. I have become the minute hand, not advancing. What is correct term for claustrophobia brought on by space travel with ravenous, curious grandchild of not yet 1 year? Spirit collects in arrowhead of stainless minute hand as final bubble of breath exits kill hole. Journey terminal. Parents of tireless, buck-eyed, beloved will return from noble work to recover body when? Perhaps you remember, Berriman, in the Mimbre's pot, the hunter's splayed quiver and the hovering bear, one black arrow through its chest. The bear's teeth pop out of its mouth like chiclets. It's so shocked to be struck from this wee distance. In one of his dream songs, Berriman fantasizes about having a detached relationship to death. And he thinks about what it would be like to be an archaeologist, a collator of bones. This poem is a response to that. Professional. Collator of bones. Speaking of professions, why not pursue archaeology of shapely calcium? The country's low on jobs right now, not making much. Top down, bottoms up. Is not proper time for sifting through deficit sentiments to ascertain how skeletal predecessors swung and slashed and sidled up to chew upon new neighbors? Whether digits scraped sinew or crushed thistle, whose bone house hoarded breath, whose bonfire burned sleeping braid of children, who worried, who tilled till the cows come home, who raided native stores, who wove flax into singlet, who slaked thirst, who sucked marrow, who mucked sorrow, collator of questions, another underutilized profession. What is the difference between a poet and an archaeologist? Simple, one has niftier trowels and sifters, not to mention radiocarbon dating. Let's turn off the radio and get the nation back to bone work, cooked to charcoal, tossed for prophecy, grind the old cows into gelatin, toothpaste, marshmallows, dust them off, displace them in glass cases, pinky to pointer, femur, tibia, fibulae, fanning out to white xylophones of ecstatic capability. You say already the jobless are lined up? No problem. Charge admission. This is a poem, in a way, about the Berryman's contemporaries, who, despite the illnesses and the addictions that beset them, had every one of them an extraordinary gift of language, which, most people who are addicted don't. So this is, in a way, a poem that comes to that discovery. Anxiety. Even the seated ruin, Yeats, still knocks on old pussycats, revolting door. Old pussycat was one of Berryman's nicknames for himself. Still knocks on old pussycat's revolting door. There behind the conga line of dead poet pals armed with fountain pens, Ruthke, Schwartz, Simpson, Lowell, Jarrell, and others, tenured, published, prize-winning drinkers, depressives, over and under medicated, sketchy husbands, but excellent letter writers. Pills per page, ounces per image, books per wife, not calculated. Other ghosts are invited to the party. Crane, Fitzgerald, Rilke, Whitman, fellow experts of the missile metal hard, fired from within, not to be resisted or rejected, only answered. But answered. A little indwelling cannot help but bring one round to the songless drinkers, to one in particular whose binges, blackouts, kicks when down, never cauterized into lyrics, not even limericks between covers. Are the lone flying wordless tipplers more to be criticized for pouring self-pity over ice, for sleeping mutely in their own illness, not commemorating even the slim arms that drag them to bed every night? In their passing out, are they to be blamed for crossing over into regions neither holy nor heroic, not even clever? Theirs is the art of erasure, unlike the gabby generation of unrecoverable poets whose art depended on their drinking, hung on it, as Berryman's still-breathing songs hang like trophies in the den of his father's death. Okay, this is another poem starring my grandson. Drama, it's called. Craves theatricality, not yet won, grandson. You should see Pumpkin grin when we shout, ow! Extreme versions of his own vowel chains delivered close to face bring exquisite fits of delight. Of no importance, sound, meaning, appropriation. He's tuned only to implied narratives, repetition, 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 variety, or low-crawling exploratory ahs and ums dropped suddenly off cliff into boo. Wiggle lips, widen eyes, talk, sing, sing, talk, repeat everything at greater speed, one octave lower. This is love. Firm believer in metaphor, our boy. Mother, a lion. Fine. Father, gorilla. Naturally. Then this. Having finally mastered eye-level white knob of kitchen cabinet, having like weightlifter arranged feet to back up diapered core, he in triumph opens door on red and silver celebrants of darkness stacked with lids. Not the soft, full darkness under mother's shirt, not blind excitement of being flung from arms to more arms, caught. No, before him now is penetrable space with possibility of fitting whole head in, whole chest. With knees, even deeper entry reached, stockpots, saucepans, little oddball tribes, loose lids, avalanche, temporary joy of unifying instant of big noise, arms flap. But wait, boy's hand is inexplicably attached to bakelite knob of old aluminum lid, knob sticking to fist. It sticks, driving child ass backwards out of borrowed universe into old mapped world of kitchen linoleum. Lid departs stiff fingers, spins and shudders, a near collapse, and then a clamorous revival as it ticks against the floor and gains wobbly momentum, crazed as squirrel dithering across bad branch. Boy cannot crawl fast enough away. Such instability will be no discovery of his. Objects are what one makes of them, spaghetti box to wear like sock, ladle to make parents sing. What is this angry thing that won't stay up or down or still? Even in next room, its independence terrifies. One remedy, colossus mother, legs of marble, perfect arms. And I'm going to end with a poem that makes use of the Anglo-Saxons have a lot of words for evening and events that take place in evening. Effen is evening. But probably someone here speaks Anglo-Saxon. So if you do, bear with me. I'm sure I'm saying half these words wrong. In elders' speech, emphasis not on dawn, moment commencing men and women equal drudgery, but on evening, Efenlaken, to grow towards evening, a time so longed for, sky-watched, it earned its own music, Efendream, evensong. Bring evening in, never-ending net of herring, sung by the Efenscope, the bard of evening. Hard-won leisure for Efensprek, evening talk, and the wide skirts of Efen schema, evening splendor. The icy night, the mead hall, the hammered helmet, are silent tumuli minus evening's bright inventions. What is drunkenness without a well-fermented song, or the sorrow of war, without once more drawing enemy blood in the company of one's own people? Dull the splendors of darkness compared to those of dusk, when the brown moor ponies are limbed with gold and the seabirds dive deep into the rippling crucible to return with delicacies of garnet and pearl. Efen, even a small man's shadow will cast a superior tale. Thank you.
I set out now in a box upon the sea.